Once more unto the breach, dear friends.
Else fill the wall up with our English dead.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jake and...
Jeff McClure.
Together we are bald.
And say our names together.
Sometimes. Sometimes appropriate.
Sometimes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
Now we have said our introduction, and the rest is a lot less exciting. Well, except for this exciting part, right? No, that's not very exciting.
We've got a little bit of an inverted yield curve in the wrong place. That's exciting.
Oh, yeah. So we will be talking about the dreary science today, the dismal science, the one that everyone says is the least interesting. Well, we're going to try to make it more interesting. We're going to do our best, but we're bald. So that's our first disclosure.
Yep.
Right. Our second disclosure is that the Personal Wealth Coach is not just the name of this radio program. It's also the name of a registered investment advisory firm that's registered with the SEC. Why are we telling you that? Because they wish us to, and it's a good idea to know that we have a professional side to what we're doing as well as this weird radio stuff. But I just said it's registered to give investment advice with the SEC. But we can't do that on the air because fiduciary investment advice, we have to know who you are and we have to be private about what we say. There's a little problem with both of those on the radio. So what we do on the radio is education. Do we get some benefit from it? Sure. Sometimes people call us to do business with us after having listened to the radio program for lots of years. Rarely after the first listen. After the first listen, they're probably getting medicated in their wondering what it was that just happened to them, and whoa, that was a weird program. Why didn't I change the channel? After about the third time they listen, they're hooked, and the first one's always free. On top of that, just because we're registered with at the firm level with the SEC doesn't mean that they approve of us. Because
boy, is that an understatement?
That's not how they do it. They don't approve stuff. There's no approval. If you're approval seeking, you've got issues with a parent and you really wish for approval, you're going to need a lot of therapy if you ever register with the SEC because you get none from them. You do get disapproval occasionally. We have so far avoided all the disapproval side, which is nice. That they are the SEC, though. So their job is to find things to disapprove, just like the police are not supposed to go out and tell you, well done, you have followed the law. It's more like they say, hey, you're breaking the law there. You got to stop it. So those are my first two disclosures. Do you have one that you would wish?
Well, there's always the one that we're not paid to do this radio program.
That's true.
Nor do we pay the radio station to do the program. We do it out of the goodness of our hearts. It does provide us some benefits. So we have obtained a few clients in the 26 years I think we've been doing this. Not very many. And if we do a cost-benefit analysis, I think considering our time and all things considered, I don't think it's
all things considered,
a very good advertisement.
That's a different radio thing.
See, what else? Oh, yeah, we advertise on KTEM for the radio show.
Yes, and which KTEM also advertises for the radio program.
That's good.
Yes.
The information that we provide on this educational radio program has been obtained from sources we deem to be reliable, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness of said information. See, this is my one time a week I get to say deem and accuracy or completeness
of said information. We right. also, and this is my favorite part, I have to add this in, I may have to do this forever, henceforth. We also do not guarantee the accuracy or completeness of unsaid information.
I do.
I could guarantee its
I will guarantee the incompleteness of unsaid information.
Perfect. That's the only guarantee we can give today. I guarantee it. Oh, no!
And if you would like to join with us, presuming that today is the second day of April, the day after April Fool's Day, if you survive April Fool's Day, and the year is 2022, so it's 4222. If that's the date, you're certainly welcome to send us an email and we'll address it on the air, Lord willing. And our email addresses, and preferably send to both of them, are jake@tpwc.com and jeff@tpwc.com. See how carefully I enunciated the TPWC?
It's still hard. It's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or the Personal Wealth Coach. And now we get into the last week. Something has happened in the financial world as a whole, and you're about to tell us what's happened in the markets.
So you're saying the financial world as a whole?
It is a whole.
Oh.
So it's like the donut hole, only it's not the piece that fills the donut hole. It's like really is the hole.
It was another one of those weeks where a person could be forgiven for assuming that the market would go down because the news was bad all week. Even the good news was bad news. The fear is still out there and much talked about that the Fed is going to raise interest rates too much and it's going to cause a recession and the world's going to end. The fear is out there that Russia is going to do something and cause a recession and the world will end. And that the price of oil and inflation is so high that we'll do something and it'll cause the world to end. But that's typical.
So far, the world is not ended.
Right. I haven't been all the way around the world, but I've been quite a few places in the world, and it doesn't look like it has an end, but we'll see.
Rock and roll is here to stay. That's what you're saying.
Got that. Or world without end. Amen.
Yes.
There's this year and this week, the stock market has been of two minds, if presuming it has a mind.
I think it has more than two, but go ahead.
Well, two opinions driving the stock market.
Right.
One is when investors look at the condition of the United States economy. The United States economy is running full out, probably at max capacity across the board, doing exceptionally well. It has a tremendous amount of momentum. Employers are hiring. Houses are being sold. People are buying things. They want to buy more things than people want to sell, which is an indicative of a fast-growing economy. And, for example, in the fourth quarter, on an annualized basis, and I want to talk about that today, by the way, GDP was up 7%. Now, then there's the other side of it. The Federal Reserve has said, hey, interest rates are astonishingly low. We are stimulating the economy. We're going to stop doing that, so we're going to raise interest rates back up to neutral. And we're going to stop pouring money into the economy, which immediately causes a panic among people who mostly, I think, don't know what that means, that the Federal Reserve is going to raise interest rates so much it's going to crush the economy and send us into a recession, which has happened a few times in the past, mostly in the distant past. And there's also the fear that Russia is going to do something or something's going to happen there, or that inflation is too high. But for the week, the S&P 500 stock index, if you looked at it at the beginning of the week and looked at it at the end, you say nothing of any significance happens. It actually rose 0.06%, closed at 4545.86. It's down 4.62% year to date. It's up 13% from this time last year.
So if basically what you're saying, if you only got a weekly update on this number, it'd be really, really easy to assume that nothing happened this week.
Right. Or almost nothing.
Almost nothing.
Actually, if you looked at it a year ago and you looked at it today, you said, wow, the market's really up. It's up 13% in a year, which is a lot.
Nothing bad could have happened during that time period, or this wouldn't be. Well,
right.
Right.
It ended the first quarter down about 5.5%. Then it came back a little bit. But this is the way it's going. And the battle between the bears and the bulls is going full blast. The CRSP Mid-Cap Value Index, the other one we follow, because we like mid-cap value as an indicator. It was down 0.16 for the week. It closed at 2596.57, if you're keeping records on that. But it's down only 0.03% in 21. Now, there's one other thing about the stock market I want to mention, that only geeky market observers like me and probably you would notice. Technically, according to somebody, and I'm not even sure who, a correction occurs when the market drops 10%, which it did early in March. It was 10% below its high at the end of last year. When it rises 10% from the 10% drop, which doesn't, by the way, put it back where it was, 10% down, 10% up, you don't get back everything. But when it rises 10% from the bottom, technically the correction is over. The correction was technically over on Tuesday. So I would just like to say that.
We had a correction. Technical correction was corrected and uncorrectable on Tuesday. Right.
Or incorrigible, as the case may be. The 10-year U.S. Treasury note. Interest rates. This is a big subject in the economic and financial stuff this week. It went down about 4% for the week, the 10-year U.S. Treasury note, to end at 2.381%. Now, to put that in perspective, remember at the beginning of last year, a year and a quarter ago, it was at 0.91. Now it's almost 2.4. It's also the 10-year Treasury note interest rate, the yield, is lower than that of the 2, 3, 5, and 7-year notes. which is a little bit of an inversion, which caused a lot of panic in the pundits to start pundating about how a recession is coming because there's an inversion somewhere in the yield curve. Not true, and we can talk about that.
We will. 3-year note. We will talk about that in probably more detail than anybody has ever wanted to know about yield curves in general. We'll give you all of that. Yes, it's coming.
The 3-year note is paying 2.623%, which is interesting. And we can talk about that at length. Crude oil, WTI.
Now, hey, there's no need to get crude here. What is going on?
There is. Because you have to get crude before you can get gas.
Oh, well, that's sweet of you. Wait, no, that's the oil as well. Never mind. Go ahead.
Right. And you have to get crude before you get gas, and then you go to the place where it says, get gas, eat here. Or eat here, get gas.
Yes.
Listen to the price of oil, $99.34 per barrel. Now, here's what I find is fascinating. Way before the Russian invasion, before we knew that there was going to be a significant restriction in the quantity of oil flowing around the world and prices were going to go high and everybody was going to panic and run in circles, when in trouble, when in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout was to be the
That's the new anthem. Yes, the new anthem.
Widely, it was forecast that as we approach summer, and we're approaching summer, oil, WTI, would rise to about $100 a barrel, simply because of demand.
Right.
And it's at $99.34 per barrel, which is, man, that's one of those things that you won't see in the headlines. Everything is now proceeding exactly as it was forecast 6 months ago. Headline.
Yes.
Which is what's happening. So oil is now down, and you won't see that in the headlines. The price of oil has dropped 20% from where it was in March when it was at 123.70. So the price of oil is down 20%. Now, does that mean that the price at the gas pump is going to come down immediately? Probably not immediately, and there's a reason for that. I guess we're slipping off into something else now, but I want to say that. U.S. refineries, I'm off the market now. I'm going to talk about something else for a second. U.S. refineries are operating at pretty close to maximum capacity right now across the board, which is brings some political things to mind and other things. They're operating at 92.6%. You said, why can't they operate at 100%? Because they have to do maintenance. Normally, they shut down to about 80-something percent this time of year and do maintenance on the refineries in preparation for the summer demand.
Right.
They're operating at basically 100% for a couple of reasons. One, Europe wants to buy stuff. Two, Americans, now that the pandemic may not be over, but they feel like it's over, are hitting the road and burning a lot of fuel. And if you don't believe that, just look at I-35. So oil is down to $99.34. And I expect we will see gasoline prices start to decline soon. Not a lot. And the reason they're not going to decline a lot is very, very simple. These refineries, particularly the ones that make gasoline and diesel, are indeed operating at full capacity, but they're also selling a significant quantity of that stuff to the rest of the world, which is something, oddly enough, we wanted. I've heard a lot of people, particularly on the conservative side, say that we need to have more exports and lower, or we don't necessarily need to lower imports. We need to have higher exports. Well, guess what, folks? We have higher exports. And we have higher exports because the Europeans and Asians and Africans and South Americans and everybody else are quite willing to pay a lot of money for gasoline because they're not getting as much from Russia as they used to. And the end result is we're exporting because it's profitable to export, and that makes the price, that makes for a shortage of gasoline in the United States, which means the prices are going to go up. And interestingly enough, I have seen letters to the editor and comments in online articles that are saying we should stop exporting so much oil and gasoline.
Wow.
And lower our prices here. Now, I think these are the same people who were complaining earlier that we didn't export enough and we needed to raise our exports and lower our imports or something like that. So it's interesting. That's just, oh, and I want to throw one other thing in here. Which it isn't political, it's economic, but it's going to sound political. So just hang on to your hats a minute. The Keystone XL pipeline.
Yeah, this is the one that was in the news that was had big protests to stop it. There were fights back and forth. It's the one that's coming from Canada, from the tar sands of Canada, that's supposed to pipe down into the refining facilities in Galveston.
Now, this is an interesting point. The Keystone pipeline already exists and it's pumping oil.
Right. It's the Keystone 2 that was the issue. So, yeah, go ahead.
The Keystone XL was a shortcut.
Right.
Get the oil faster to the refineries. Virtually none of which, by the way, would have been turned into gasoline for Americans because it is
Not good for gasoline.
Extremely heavy, extremely dirty, extremely sour oil that has very little gasoline in it. And the results of that oil, if it were processed, are almost totally exported from the United States. We don't keep much of it, or any of it at all. That's number one. Number two, interesting point, I think, the refineries are operating at capacity. If there was more oil coming in from Canada, would it lower the price of gasoline? Every study I've read agrees on this point. Not a penny. It would have no effect.
Now, there's one more question that I regularly get on this subject when we talk about capacity at the refinery. Man, we must talk about this a lot if people ask us questions about it. Well, we haven't really increased refining capacity except for one major event for about the past 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Katrina, the hurricane that hit the Gulf and New Orleans and knocked out a bunch of the refining capacity in the Gulf area. They didn't increase the square footage or the footprint on the ground for their refineries, but they were able to come in and upgrade them to newer technology. And that's a big deal because it's really hard to build refineries. Not because the architecture is difficult or the engineering is difficult. That's true, but that's kind of a given. If you're doing a skyscraper, it's difficult architecture and engineering as well. It's because it's really hard to do for environmental reasons. It's hard to do this just like it's hard to put in a nuclear power plant. You can do it. It just takes a long time. So the last major upgrade to capacity took place after Katrina. Been more than a decade. It's been significantly more than a decade.
When you talk about environmental capacity, environmental stuff, and there's a kind of a knee-jerk reaction among many people I know who said, oh, those environments, if we just need to build more refineries, it's the environment. No. When we talk about environmental issues, it's like, presuming we've got a lot of listeners. We've got listeners all over the place, but let's just
That's quite a big presumption. Yeah, go ahead.
Presuming we have listeners. Let's just say on the south side of Temple, Exxon says we're going to build a really big refinery. Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
There will be a lot of people who are driving cars that drink gas, that are getting power made from gas, that will be upset about that. Houston, I think Houston's a great example of this. Houston, you're not going to find a group of people more warmly inclined to the oil and gas industry than Houston, Texas.
Right.
And yet there's not a federal mandate that says you can't build lots of refineries. It's dirty. And people tend to say, that looks bad on the horizon and stuff like that.
It doesn't just look bad. There's an old motto. I used to live in Houston, and it was, don't trust air you can't smell.
Right.
So and when the wind came from the south, over Texas City and the refineries down there, the smell in Houston is noticeably petroleum.
So this is the deal. And we can come up with newer and better ways of doing this. And we're probably going to start thinking hard about doing it now because the oil price is high enough again that we can say, oh, it's going to be really profitable to build some more refineries. We need to do it right. And that's the thing, is that the price of oil might collapse back down. It's going to collapse back down again. Why do I know that with great surety? Because it always has. It always goes up and it always goes down until it's replaced.
I can also say that given the mandate that came out this week, I think 46 miles per gallon minimum? By 2030, is it? 2026
I was
or
just looking at it. I don't have the story in front of me.
Anyway, we're burning less fuel per capita in the United States than we have in many decades, and it's probably going to continue to accelerate. And if you don't understand why, just drive through West Texas sometime and look at the wind farms. Natural gas is a better source of energy for electricity, and we're going to probably burn less and less fuel. We have a temporary reversal in that process right now, but if you're going to build a refinery, you recover the value of your building, your capital costs, over a 30-year period. And if you look 30 years into the future and say, how much petroleum will we need to refine 15 years from now, halfway to that recovery point.
And then
you might conclude that maybe we won't be burning that much petroleum 15 years from now.
Yeah, the rule that just came out is 49 miles per gallon.
Oh, it's 49, right.
Yeah.
By when?
It is in the model year 2026, which will start mm-hmm. hitting showrooms in 2025. So yep. That's 49 miles per gallon standard. Now, there's lots of wiggle room in there. It's averaged across manufacturing, so there's going to be cars that have a lot less than that and other cars that have more. There's all kinds of, it's a governmental rule, so there's all kinds of tiny little quirks to it. But on a whole, the average is going to be about 49 miles per gallon. And I had a 1982 Chevy pickup as a farm truck for a long time, and it got 6 miles per gallon downhill.
Downhill with the wind.
With the tailwind.
With the tailwind.
Right. So that says a lot that we're talking about a nearly 10% improvement on that. Or 10%. Nearly 10 times.
1,000% improvement.
Yeah, 1,000. Yep. Near there. That
1,010. Those are close together.
If you think about a 900% improvement in efficiency in gasoline, that's one of the things that's happening right now. It's a government mandate, but you can't do a government mandate unless the technology is there or just everybody fails. The technology's there, and it probably means that there's going to be a lot of uproar from the auto industry saying, then get the ethanol out of the gas because it's lower. It is making our fuel efficiency less. So that's coming probably too.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Let's get the ethanol out of the gas. I'll agree with that one. And we're going electric. Just get used to it, folks.
Yeah, it's cheaper now. And this isn't an ecological thing. You hear us talking about oil and gas and us looking. Profitability is where things are. And if the market is changing, it doesn't matter how much you subsidize coal or the government comes in and pays the coal miners. If no one buys the coal, eventually it's just the government and you have Amtrak. Sorry, I just switched subjects a little bit. Amtrak is a train that the government said, we're not going to get rid of passenger trains in our country. No, we're not. Even though the market has already left it behind, we are going to keep it forever. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work in coal, and eventually it won't work in the other petroleum product if we have a clean, less important than anything else in the rest of the subjects is the clean part. Cheaper and better and more efficient technology. The cheaper and more efficient is what trumps whatever is going on. And then you can pat yourself on the back about ethicalness and cleanliness and all the rest of that stuff.
Let me throw in a little caveat on Amtrak.
Okay.
Amtrak is very useful and actually profitable in the Northeastern Corridor.
Yeah, in the very small area of the Northeastern Corridor.
Yeah, where you're going from like Washington to New York, up and down that corridor where the Acela and other similar trains go that are typically full. They typically make a profit. People use them a lot because it's a lot quicker to go. It's actually quicker to go by train than it is to drive to the airport, park your car, and go through the entire thing of getting on an airplane and flying from one to the other. The train is quicker, it's cheaper, and a lot of people use it. Now, once you get further out west where the scenic tours are, it gets pretty expensive. And we took a vacation last year to Oregon and thought about taking the Amtrak train to Oregon. First off, it takes a long time to get there. And secondly, it was outrageously expensive. It was a lot cheaper to fly and rent a car and do everything that we needed to do than it would be to take a train. So Amtrak, as much as I love trains, because I grew up riding trains, why we're running passenger trains across the United States and subsidizing them with tax money is a little beyond my comprehension.
So all that comes back to oil and gas. Eventually, if you have a technology that's an amazing technology, but it's no longer the one that the market is using because another technology has replaced it, I don't care if that means the big box television with a tube in the middle of it that was made in America by Curtis Mathis. If the government keeps giving Curtis Mathis money to make televisions that nobody wants to buy, it's a bad use of the money. So this is, I know that there are a lot of pre-existing battle lines drawn on the eco map, the green energy versus the petroleum energy. Anybody that's listened to us for very long knows that we laugh heartily at this concept because green energy is not green either. You can't recycle the windmills. They have stuff in them that is unrecyclable. They will be sitting there forever. Nuclear power has to be has a dirty side of it. Lithium in the batteries is not green. I don't care how you try to measure it as green. It's not green. You don't want it in the groundwater. You need to be very careful while you're digging it up. So it's not between the ecology and the anti-ecology, or between oil and green. It's over, number one, we need a technology that allows us to increase our business, to do our business the way we need to do our business and be profitable at it. So it needs to be cheap and it needs to be accessible. Number two is eventually we would really like it to not make us die early from breathing it or have acid rain or any of the other things that we've learned throughout history that you don't eat or drink because it's poison. We also are now learning you don't breathe this stuff because it's poison. And we've made a big effort of exporting most of our plastic refining to somewhere else because when you're molding plastic, it makes stuff in the air. Well, you look at the air in China, it's pretty bad. And we point over them and look at their smog. It's horrible.
And yeah, you can look at the air in China. That's the important thing.
Yeah, it is. You can eat the air in China. But where
some people do.
Why is it that bad over there? Well, because we're buying this stuff from them. We exported the pollution as well as the manufacturing. And as we bring that manufacturing back, we have new rules on pollution. So we're getting better at the manufacturing without poisoning the entire air that we're breathing. Anybody also that listens to me for very long also knows that I think that the whole concept of the environmental movement is a human-centric kind of selfish thing. Because before humanity was the leading power on the planet was killing species and making new species and you know, impacts of meteors were doing that, and we had extinction events and all that stuff. And yeah, humans are the latest thing that's causing that. If people are saying save the planet, they're really meaning save the planet for us. I'm okay with that. I don't think there's a problem with that. So long as we don't prevent ourselves from also improving in the process. So all this comes back to when new technology shows up, that new technology can allow us to not be as dirty with the stuff around us and then to be proud of that. When somebody comes up and says you should stop being so dirty when you work in a coal mine and they're buying your coal, that's hypocrisy. And I have a lot of trouble with that. When someone comes up and says you're dirty, you should stop because this thing over here is cheaper and you're just taking government pay to do something dirty, I'm okay with that side. And this comes back to Amtrak. I think it's a really great concept to have trains with passengers in them. It's very profitable across Europe. It's profitable in China. It's profitable in the rest of the world and not so much in the United States because we use our rails for cargo. And that means all our passenger lines run late and we fly because we tend to be wealthier per capita than Europe and China. So we can afford to fly. So government subsidies should be targeted. I believe in having government subsidies for farming because we don't want to export all the farming. We want to import farming. We want more farmers. Why? Well, because at some point, the rest of the world might not want to give us their food, even if we want to buy it. So having that here is important. There's some other things that are strategically important to have here. But when you start delineating between green and not green, this leads nicely to my next point. I don't know if you saw the article this last week about, this is the headline, Russia war in Ukraine exposes weakness in ESG.
Yes.
ESG is environmental, social, and governance. And again, if you've listened to us very long, we have talked about what a joke that is, that who sets these gauges? Who says if it's environmental? Is lithium environmental? I've just said it's pretty dirty, but it's better for the carbon in the air, so it must be clean. Well, no, don't get it in the water. So it falls under the E in ESG. So can natural gas, which will confuse a lot of diehard environmentalists. What? Natural gas is considered E in ESG? Yeah, because it's cleaner than coal. Social. What does that even mean? Which social? If you feel one way socially, you could say, yeah, this company's doing that. And somebody else could disagree with you completely because they feel another way socially. And then there's G. And this is the one that's really in this particular story. ESG funds have been buying Russia for years. And anybody can look at the G, which is governance, and say, Russia's going the wrong direction on that and has been for 22 years. They're not holding free elections anymore. They're being very, very closed on the media. There's no way you can say G is a good thing in Russia in the ESG. And the Wall Street Journal's coming out and finally saying, hey, there's some hypocrisy here. There are companies that have, I mean, I'm going to be equal across the board. And I know this is maybe bad timing to say it about Ukraine, but there's a lot of corruption in the Ukrainian government. Not up close to the top, that's easy to find, but in the middle ranks, the bureaucratic ranks, there's a lot of graft. And that's just kind of an expected thing in Eastern Europe. That doesn't mean that there's not corruption higher up too. There's just less evidence of it. So to just kind of lay that out there. Anybody that's looking at ESG and says, hey, it's a good idea to invest in Ukraine and in Russia, I have to look at what is their standard for governance, because they're not doing what we would consider clearly fair governing. Even when you look at the United States, you know, people have questions about voting machines and so on, but at least there's a lot of attention that gets put on it, and it is publicized. Elsewhere in the world, it's not. So ESG, again, coming back to this, it's a big trend, and people come to me and say, hey, do you use that ESG stuff? I want to feel good about what I'm investing in. And my answer to that is the same every time. The only way to feel good about what you're investing in is to know what you're investing in.
There it is.
Having somebody else put a label on it for you, it is not real feel good. It's you're just letting somebody else pat you on the head and saying, yeah, it's taken care of. That internal investigation in what you own, if you feel strongly about things and you don't want to own certain things, you should investigate that or hire someone to do it. If someone's offering you a free label and you don't know the standards behind the label, then it may make you feel good, but I don't know. It's just a whitewash on a falling down building.
It's important to say about ESG, if you're an investor and you're thinking, or you know someone who's thinking about ESG investing, there is no standard for what is ESG. There's lots of standards.
Yeah,
lots of
everybody has their own.
And I was looking through some of the ones that Morningstar say have high ESG ratings and included petroleum companies, which I thought was fascinating. It is...
I mean, not that petroleum companies are bad. We've said this again and again. My car runs on gas. The electricity in my house comes probably from natural gas being burned. So this whole concept about green, not green, we think it's silly. But that label of E on petroleum products, if you went to an environmentalist and said, is a petroleum company an environmentalist advocate? I bet you know the answer you'll get. So who's setting the standards? And this is the answer, is that the person that is selling you the product is setting the standards right now, and they get to tell you something that'll make you want to buy the product. Well, the SEC is opening up standards, or at least opening up hearings on the discussion for having a meeting to have more hearings about the standards around possibly more meetings on setting standards for ESG. So it's the government. And we have a question from Inquisitor John that we would like to get to after the break, because it is an excellent question. He's asking, I'll say the question before the break. He's asking, what is inverse exposure? And he's got the Wall Street Journal, a picture of it with a circle around a particular paragraph. But I just wish that we didn't have context and he was just asking us what is inverse exposure, I would say that's wearing clothes. It means that you're not exposed anymore. That's not what it means in the market, though. And we will get to that. We'll get to what is inverse exposure and does it work for what it's supposed to be doing? And because the idea is that it's supposed to prevent risk. We'll talk about that after the break. However, if you have a question you would like to ask during the break or after, we have email addresses open and waiting. Excuse me. We have jeff@tpwc.com. That's Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie or The Personal Wealth Coach. .com or jake@tpwc.com. And in the meantime, we're going to have this break and we'll be back on the other side with more of The Personal Wealth Coach. Back with more of The Personal Wealth Coach with Jake and
Jeff McClure.
All right. Well, back to the question from Inquisitor John, our most loyal and faithful questioner. He says that the subject line is, what is inverse exposure? And then he's got a picture of the Wall Street Journal, the headline being risky stock bets soar in popularity. And then it says three of the other 10 most actively traded exchange traded products also offer leverage or inverse exposure to the market, allowing investors to magnify their investments or bet on a fall. What does that mean? Okay. This gets into one of those silly, silly areas of the investment world that almost no one really understands. The few people that do, there's probably a lot of people that claim to understand it that really don't. And then there's a few people that understand. I'm not sure I fully understand it. And I've been looking at this stuff for, I was just looking at it, 31 years. First off, here's some simple ways for when it says leverage. Okay. Let's say that you have some, this goes back to an early concept called hedging your investment. This is where the term hedge fund comes from, but hedge funds don't do it anymore, or very few of them do. Hedging your investment would be if you own a stock and you're afraid it's going to drop. You look around at the market and you say, hey, will anyone let me pay you some money today so that I can sell the stock to you at the same price it is today over the next 3 months? I'll pay you some money so that you can do this. And then if I don't sell it to you, you just have this money. So you're buying the right to sell it at a price. That's one way of hedging it. And that's also known as inverse exposure, because exposure means how much risk do you have? Your risk, the market could drop. Well, if you have the right to sell your stocks at today's value, well, then you didn't drop with the market. You just lost whatever you paid for that right. I know that's a little bit convoluted, but wait, it's going to get more so. Sometimes people borrow the stock or borrow the money to buy the stock, or sometimes they borrow the stock with borrowed money. This is called leverage, and it means that you don't have as much money in your initial investment. It's other people's money that you're using, which means that if you get to keep all the gains and you just have to pay back the borrow cost, then you could make this big return on a much smaller amount of money. And it sounds great, except that you have the other end of that too. You can wind up losing more than you invested because you still have to pay back the rest of that borrowed money. And if the stock drops to nothing, it goes away, which is why that headline says risky stock bets soar in popularity, because they're not using words that we're used to hearing. They're not saying, let's borrow a bunch of money to buy this stock, this risky stock. They're saying, let's use some leverage and maybe some inverse exposure to get this thing done. And people go, oh, that sounds really smart. Let's do that. Does it work? Sometimes.
Well, it all depends.
Yeah, it all depends. Sometimes it works. It has to be set up right. And the reality is that it creates more friction on the growth in your portfolio because you got to be paying money for this stuff, either in interest charges on borrowed stuff or on selling when you don't want to sell because the market is down, but you need to meet your minimums in the margin area. There's a lot of complexity here. You have to it's a lot easier for it to not work than it is for it to work. That is my statement on it. You want to add to that?
I did some numbers on this a while back, and there's some leveraged funds out there that there's a whole family that does extensive 50% leveraged funds. In other words, if you buy into the fund, there's a portfolio of stocks and they borrow 50% of the value. So you get 150% of the stocks that you're actually buying. And man, if the market was going up, it's 50% leverage. You look puzzled, like, okay.
Right.
So you basically get 1.5 times, theoretically 1.5 times the stock you're buying in, which really sounds cool. So if the market goes up 10%, you would expect to go up, what, 15%? It doesn't work that way, though. Go up about 13% instead of 15%. Why? Well, you got to pay interest on the borrowed money.
Yep. And that's that friction we're talking about.
And there's just a lot of friction that goes on in there. The same thing is true, and that's what John is asking about. Reverse.
Or inverse.
Inverse. Or basically, the easiest way to inverse the market is to short it. Basically, you borrow money to buy stocks or a stock index.
Or you borrow the stock in the same way.
Well, you borrow the money in most cases, if it's leveraged index, inverse. You borrow some money, you buy some stocks that you didn't really buy because you just borrowed them. And you pay interest on the borrowed money. And you pay interest on the borrowed stock. And if the market goes down a lot, you make a significant amount of money, make more money than if you just shorted the stock. If the market goes up a lot, you lose
lots.
A lot more than you gain if it goes down.
Yeah.
And it is, you just have to be lucky. It's a gambling.
And this is that type of bet, by the way, has an unlimited downside.
Right.
That means that there's no limit on the amount you can lose when you use that type of leverage. It is extremely dangerous. It means that you could borrow a relatively small amount and then with no downside, you could lose a tremendously large amount. There were some big headlines last year about this time at Robinhood for a bunch of people that didn't know what they were doing and were getting into leveraging and such, and they wound up with bills of millions of dollars on a $50,000 purchase. Some of you may remember that stuff. That's what they were doing. They were trying to inverse the market. When you're borrowing stuff, you have to pay it back. And when you're borrowing stock, you have to buy the stock to pay it back if you already sold it. So if that's
borrowing money to borrow the stock, it can get nasty in a big hurry.
Yeah. So
in other words, it's possible to use inverse leverage and wind up with, let's say in this case, you're talking about a $50,000 investment and wind up in bankruptcy.
Yeah. So all that being said, when a fund, an exchange-traded product, does it, there's a lot of disclosure requirements. You know those prospectuses that nobody ever reads? Well, those are important to read. That's why the government makes all advertisements about them, say, at the end of it, please read this prospectus carefully before investing.
Sure.
And everybody goes, oh, yeah, right, this is just a bunch of small print. Who needs it? Well, you need to actually understand that stuff if you're putting a large amount of money into it. It'd be like selling your business without reading the contract. You may not get or be getting what you think you are if you don't read it. And I think people get so used to just clicking the end user license agreement, I agree, on their phone. It's got 197 pages of stuff in it that nobody can understand. And you're supposed to agree to it. It's some sort of agreement that has maybe some problems if you don't do what you're supposed to do. Nobody knows what they're supposed to do. Prospectuses are important, and reading them is important. Understanding what this this seems to be a theme today. And the only way to understand what you're invested in is to actually understand what you're invested in. So there are very popular strategies right now that are taking on larger and larger amounts of risk because the investors of today have gotten used to very high double-digit returns. And we've had a bit of a dip over the last quarter. We've had a quarter of negative. And that causes all the marketers to go out there and say, well, what can we do to try to get a higher return than what we're getting? All that being said, read the prospectus, or at least hire a fiduciary that will read it and explain it to you, that will say this is the risk involved in what you're doing. It's important stuff. And I can't say that enough. It's like there's not enough analogies for this. When you're investing a large portion of your life savings in something and you refuse to read the document that everyone is giving you warnings that you're supposed to read, it's not the same as sitting, I agree, on your iPhone. It really isn't. It is you taking the risk and saying, I don't care. So at the very least, I would say read it. If you don't have the time or the patience to read it, find someone you trust, preferably someone who's legally obligated to be in a trustworthy position, like a fiduciary, who's going to tell you what it means. And yes, we're prejudiced on this because we are fiduciaries, but that's beside the point. It's why we're fiduciaries, because we were prejudiced before. And do you want to say something to wrap up the hour?
Well, I can just kind of summarize that for the first hour that the stock market went up a little bit this week, but the battle between the bears and the bulls is still fully underway. With in the economy, the things look really good in many ways, and we'll talk about that some more. And the inversion in the yield curve really isn't an inversion, and we didn't really talk about that, but we will next hour.
Inversion in the yield curve coming up. We've got stuff about what's happening in China right now, and there's some big news from China that's being completely lost in the big news from Ukraine, because it's bigger news from Ukraine as far as the actual shock and trauma of it. Well, the long-term impact is bigger from China. And we're about out of time for this hour. We'll be back next hour with more. But if you would like to talk to us off the air, we actually give investment advice, fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth, not just on the macro picture of what's happening across the world, but very micro down to the specific of the portfolio. We've got a local telephone line with voicemail during the weekend and real live people during the week at
254-947-1111.
Or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to the webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com. You can read our newsletters there. You can sign up for the newsletter. You can contact us through the contact form. You can go and listen to our radio programs. We've got quite a few years up on the webpage. You can see what we were saying prior to big events. See if we were right or wrong. Maybe wrong, maybe right. Check it out. Or you can contact us through the contact form or email Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com. And thank you very much for listening. Until next hour, this has been The Personal Wealth Coach, and we will be back.